You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, my bookshop, one of the last independent bookshops in the area. The book we'll be talking about today, The Golem and the Genie, is featured prominently, just released in paperback. It was released in hardback back in April of last year and released in paperback the last day of last year, December 31st. And it's been flying off the shelves both in hardback and paperback and still is on a lot of the most of the bestseller list. So we're really happy today to have Helene with us. The author is Helene Wicker. The story, The Golem and the Genie, it's about two fantastical creatures who join together and about their relationship, the idea of love, the idea of compromise, the idea of resignation, of courage, of sacrifice, and also the idea of pure evil. It's set in the end of the last century, but one. I keep forgetting we're in the 2000s now. And it's a great, great, great book. So welcome, Helene.
Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So I wanted to tell you, I have this Ben Marcus story, because I know you acknowledge Ben Marcus in your book.
Oh, Ben Marcus, he was one of my professors at Columbia, and he was on my thesis reading committee. And the first, I think it was like the first two chapters, in, you know, a very different form, were part of my my thesis for graduating Columbia. So he read them and gave me some very, very good comments that got worked into the book.
Well, I interviewed him. He was such a nice guy.
And he's amazing.
And he wrote The Flame Alphabet, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I was talking to him about that, and this leads into something about you. And I said, Ben, why do you write like it's? No one can understand what you're saying. I mean, these people are in holes and they got these tubes, and they're Jewish. And then you're at the end, you're gnawing on a bone. Why can't you just say you're gnawing on the bone instead of the way you said it? It makes no sense. And he goes, you know, well, I've tried writing things so they make sense. It just doesn't seem to work. And you know what that reminded me of? It reminded me of when you were writing and you couldn't figure out why you couldn't find your voice, and your girlfriend said, why are you writing like that? Why don't you just tell that story? That's a cool story.
No, what happened, so this is sort of the story of how the book came about, which was that when I got to Columbia and I started, you know, working on what was at that point going to be my thesis and, you know, this collection of short stories, it was about stories from my Jewish family and from my husband's Arab American family that I was sort of trying to weave together. And they were these, you know, they were like very realist, you know, they're all taken from true life. Nothing happened in them that, you know, wouldn't happen in the real world. And they were just so boring and they just sort of laid there. And I mean, looking back on it now, I think part of it was that I just, you know, it was like these stories that I knew inside out. And so I was just sort of retelling them instead of discovering them. And so I was complaining about it to this friend of mine in the workshop, and she basically yelled at me and said, why are you writing like this? Like you said, it was by the exact line, I think I'll always remember it, that she said, you know, you read nothing but science fiction and fantasy. And you know, like, you're always talking about literary fiction that incorporates genre elements. That's where your heart is. Why aren't you doing that? And that really, it was like she knew I was just looking in the wrong direction. She just sort of took my head and swiveled it around with very little warning.
You owe her a great deal of thanks.
Oh, yes. I really, really do. And that really was the beginning of the book.
It's funny because, you know, I've interviewed, like, I don't know. I interviewed Sue Monk Kidd yesterday on the Invention of Wings. That was very interesting. But she's not going to listen to this, so I like your book a lot more. I really do. Sorry.
Well, thank you.
Sorry, Sue. And you're not an Oprah Book Club book, so that also.
I won't. I never met her. I won't tell her a thing.
She's speaking at the library in Philadelphia tonight. Plus, she charges $15 to come and see her, which I don't. It's a free library in Philadelphia. Benjamin Franklin, you know why? Anyway, be that as it may. So yeah, so all these authors who write in situations where it's real and it's not real, I use the term sometimes magical realism, and I get this visceral response. It's either they love me saying that, or they despise me saying that.
Yeah.
And like, what do you think? Is it magical realism? Do you want to give it a label?
It's so fascinating because I just had a discussion with a friend about this yesterday, about how we tend to call things magical realism if it's a foreign, you know, like you know, Latin American or you know, as the
like a,
classical
like a,
definition.
Yeah, like 100 Years of Solitude.
Exactly. Or, you know, be somehow considered more highfalutin, you know, or both. And everything else is just fantasy, you know, which tends to mean to the layman that it's got dragons on the cover and probably orcs and elves and stuff, too.
Right, Anne McCafferty or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, exactly. And how so much of this really is about sort of taste and perception and what it is that we want to think of ourselves as readers and the sort of stuff that we like and not about, you know, and you know, how much of it really is just marketing and, you know, the format that it decides, you know, that it gets published in and who does the cover art that you know, in the end, there's very little, you know, sort of formalist difference between the two, at least sort of how they've become, you know, today. Maybe it would have been different, you know, back in the early 90s or the 80s. But I don't know. I mean, hey, magical realism, if you want to call it magical realism, that, please do. If you want to call it fantasy, please do. Historical fiction, literary fiction with, you know, elements of other things, hybrid, mashup. I love it. I've gone to bookstores and seen my book in at least, you know, three different sections. So, and I'm sort of, like, perversely proud of that.
Yeah, I think that's,
that it seems to be this weird sort of monster that no
yeah,
one
you're
knows
a,
what to
you're
do
a,
with.
You're a crossover like Taylor Swift.
Oh, exactly like her. Yes, that's me.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, you talk about marketing, you know, you got a great cover, a wonderful cover, and then the trailer they do with the genie just darting across the sky like a flaming meteor, which is great. And then also, you know, I also read that the audiobook is great. Whoever read it is supposed to be great.
Oh, it's George Guidall on the audiobook, and he's fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a great article, I think it's in Slate, about him and how the way you can tell if someone's reading well is there's no effort, you know?
Right.
And also the way they do women's voices, too.
Yes.
But what was I going to say? So, I know what I was going to say. When I was looking at the trailer where you were just talking about what it was like being a writer and how you wrote this, I just freeze-framed it on your library because I was listening to you, but what I really cared about was what you read. And then when I saw Anathem and the Quicksilver trilogy and Neal Stephenson, I go, okay, yeah, now I get it. But then I saw that little pig that you use for a bookend, and I wasn't sure about the pig.
Oh, that's... I think that's back from when... I had a blog back, you know, years and years and years ago, called Little Clay Pig, and I think it was because of that little pig. And people have gotten me clay pigs from different places they've gone, and that's I sort of accumulated them, and that's what that was about. But and actually, I have to fess up, the Quicksilver trilogy, I have not read it yet. My husband has read it, and it took him about 4 months. And I just feel like I do not have 4 months of time to give to Neal Stephenson, but I have read almost everything else he's written.
Me too.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, it's like looking at the Game of Thrones septology or whatever. I mean, I would love to read it all, but there's no way. I
think I got through the third book.
You did? Oh, that's better than me.
Yeah.
It's like trying to read Remembrance of Things Back Up Past by Proust. I always get to the Madelines and then I stop.
like that's about page 15.
I'm sorry. I like Madelines.
I think I've gotten to his adolescence maybe three or four times.
It's like,
and that's about it.
It's like Ulysses.
Yeah.
You know, I get to the Martello Towers, which I actually went to, which was cool. But anyway, so sorry. I end up talking all the time. I'm sorry.
And, no.
But so I gave that little blurb at the beginning, but why don't you go ahead? I know, you know, tell everyone how it took you 7 years and all the research and what the book is really about.
Okay, so, you know, it really is about, you know, people people say to me, Helene, I've never had such a hard problem describing to my friends what the book that I'm reading is about. And, you know, the line that I usually use is a golem, which in, you know, Jewish folklore is a a creature made of clay that serves a master, kind of like the Jewish version of like a Frankenstein's monster, and a genie, which, you know, we know of as sort of genie in the bottle, 1001 Nights, certainly in the West, but is, you know, still very much a part of Middle Eastern and Muslim culture and religion, a golem and a genie. In 1899, both take their very improbable ways to Manhattan and have to learn to live as humans in disguise until one night when their paths sort of inevitably cross. And so, yeah, it really did start from the family tales, because what I wanted to do was talk about issues of immigration and coming to America and being faced with a new culture and a new language and, you know, sort of always having that fish out of water, stranger in a strange land feeling. And then being the child or grandchildren of those immigrants and having that sort of handed down to you as like an inherited burden, and how it always makes you feel like a couple degrees weirder than everyone else. You're just a little bit off kilter from the rest of the culture.
I know they when my grandparents came over from Belarus, my name is Hankin, but they changed our name at Ellis Island because the name, if I pronounced it, I would spit all over the microphone.
Yep.
It was very guttural, you know. And when you described Ellis Island, and I've always thought how horrible it would be, you know, if you came over and they sent you back.
Yeah.
Especially if they were wrong.
It's
just like this pathos, you know, just horrible feeling in your heart because you know it happened over and over again.
Yeah. And how much people risked and sold and everything to make their way here. And then
what if your mother has to go back and you can stay? It's like those choices in your book, you know.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah.
Oh, the other thing I was going to tell you is I'm really mad at you. You want to know why?
Okay,
so I got to get up in the morning at 5:30 because Samantha has to be at the bus stop at 6.
Oh,
and
God.
So I started your book at 7 at night, and I finished it at 4.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I got an hour and a half of sleep. My whole day was ruined. I couldn't do any work. That's what happens when you read a great book. When you read a great book, you have to finish it in one sitting. It's impossible not to.
I'm sorry. I've had so many friends tell me that they missed their bus stop or their train stop. I'm like, I'm sorry.
Isn't that like the best compliment you can get, though?
It totally is. It really is. And I'm like, it's that whole sorry but not sorry sort of thing.
One of the funny things in the book is... you know, you have such a great way of describing your characters, and there are so many characters whose names I will soon mispronounce. But the genie, who is absolutely described as like almost androgynously as this gorgeous, beautiful creature, and he doesn't have a name. His name is Ahmad. And he's absolutely gorgeous, and you know that he is. But then Chava, who purposefully, she's striking. You don't pass her and just not swivel on Fifth Avenue and not swivel your head. But you don't know whether she's beautiful, whether she's just striking, she's massive. What is she? Is she beautiful?
I don't think she's beautiful. I think she's... I think she's sort of, I don't know, at one point she gets described as like plain but pleasing, and in that sort of, if it was any other woman who had her face, she'd be like, you know, nice to look at, but, you know, not about to win any beauty contests. But the thing that I always sort of figured on for her was that, oh goodness, I'm gonna blank on the name of it, the uncanny valley, which is the term for why we find it just really weird and creepy that things that look almost like human that aren't quite human, like the way that some like animation gets, you know, of people starts to look a little creepy, or like those very lifelike robots that just you look at them and they're like they're too like humans to not fully be human, and that gap is what really gives you that weird shiver. That's what I feel like. There's something just a little off about her that no one can quite put their finger on, and it makes her look striking in that way that no other woman would look if they had her features.
Well, it's funny because even spookier is when, and I guess I've had this happen 5 or 6 times in my life, when you meet someone who has that otherworldly, almost alien appearance. And
it's
astonishing. They have an aura about them, but they also have a look, usually in their eyes, where to me it just seems like this is not the same race that I am. But I can't explain
why. There's certain actors that it's like, you were bred in a lab, weren't you? You're just a little too perfect for this world.
Well, it's like even Christopher Walken or Jeff Goldblum. There's something off, you know?
Walken, those eyes.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking the words were in my mouth.
Yeah.
You know, and then you come up with these phrases in the book that I noted a little bit. And the one is when the guy in the desert who actually binds Ahmad, when he says allies are much more useful than bodies. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, shouldn't that be in Bartlett's quotations? Did she steal that from somewhere?
I don't know where that came from. That sort of, there are a few times like that where you write something and you're like, oh Lord, is it something I read 15 years ago that's sort of percolating its way up now, or is that, did I actually make this up? And I think with that one, I actually made it up, although I'm sure I read something, of this similar sentiment, in some epic fantasy novel when I was 14.
I can almost see you writing it and then stopping and looking up. It's like, oh. It's like whenever I write something, I always have the phrase, down the long, dusty corridors of time.
Mm-hmm.
And where the hell did that come from? But it always is the same phrase that comes in my head. Unfortunately, that's why I can't write, because every story I have has that phrase in it.
it's like you're a little Easter egg. You have to find it in every story.
It's funny because all the people in the novel, people and creatures in the novel, are basically good people. They are an admixture of characteristics. Mm-hmm. But then there's, and I'll just say it without messing up the book, there's two people, people who are inherently kind of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And the book kind of pivots totally on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this solar system that's this core of, I don't know, horror, surrounded by all these people who are kind of good. Or in the genie's case, it's like he could give he's not good or bad.
Uh-huh.
But but most of the people are good, right?
Oh yeah, most of the people are good. And I think and like you say, with those moments of those mixtures of impulse to good, impulse to evil, that maybe, and this is actually something that the golem has to learn, because she can, because of the circumstances of her making, she can hear the thoughts and the desires and fears of others. And so she has a window into those evil impulses that, most people in their day-to-day lives have and then ignore and, sort of put away. And she... It sort of freaks her out, and she has to learn not to judge people by what they do instead of what they're thinking, because otherwise, everyone's sort of a monster, when you walk down the street and you're like, oh, that person, I just want to kick them,
Right, and I'm sure you, and I know I imagine, I'm so glad that someone can't listen in on me. It just wouldn't be pleasant. But then she has her on and off switch, too.
Yeah, she
really
does.
Really nasty one.
And so that sort of goes back to the origin stories of golems and sort of that that link they have with what sort of I think of as like the tradition that goes from that up through Frankenstein to all of modern in the 50s sci-fi robots running amok. It's like what happens when we create something that turns on us. It's like the warnings against, playing God, quote unquote, and, building something that we presume too much, and then our the very thing we create is what's going to destroy us.
Right, like all the science fiction books about computers.
Oh, sure, yeah, exactly.
Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you is, have you read the book Winter's Tale by Mark Halperin?
I haven't. It's on my list.
God.
I've had so many people tell me I have to read it, and I know it's it's like everyone's favorite, and I just haven't gotten to it yet.
Well, you should, after this interview, you should hang up the phone and you should go out and buy it and read it. Seriously.
Okay.
Well, first of all, read it before the movie comes out, because it's going to come out soon, and it's got Colin Farrell and Russell Crowe, and it's not going to be as good as the book, so you have to read the book first. And you will be amazed at the parallels between your book and this book. Especially,
I know. The funny thing is, I think that's why, I mean, as, when I started to get wind of it, you know, as I was writing it, and I would describe to me what, I would describe to people what, you know, what's the book you're working on? And I would tell them, and they go, oh, you must have read A Winter's Tale. And I'm like, no, I haven't, and I have to not read it now, because apparently, you know, it was just one of those, it's too close, and I will then second-guess everything that I have possibly done with this book, and just sort of, I wanted to sort of steer clear of it, so now I feel like I can go and take a peek.
Especially with regard to Sophia.
Oh, really?
Especially. Even with spatially, the place where Sophia is almost exactly the same place in New York.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
That very high society sort of...
Almost like the Plaza Hotel kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the other thing about, I felt so bad for Sophia, you know, because Mahmoud Saleh, he, you know, he turns out okay at the end, you know, it's taken out. But but Sophia, she's left, you know, bereft, kind of, isn't she?
Yeah. I figure she's got her own agenda. She's going to go off and do a few interesting things.
But her teacup's always going to be rattling.
Yeah, that's true. Her teacup is always going to be rattling. She's always going to be a little cold.
I know. I felt so... She's so beautiful. And...
Oh.
You have to read the book. You have to read Winter's Tale. You have to.
I will.
It's funny. All these characters, like, they kind of ring true as people you know, like Maryam and her husband, Saeed. Do you know people like that? People who can just warm a room and always help? And they love each other so much, and, you know.
I do. I think I know people with aspects of that, but not sort of, I don't know, Maryam. She was never one of my, she was never one of my top favorite characters in the book, because I had problems just, you know, keeping her just she's always wanted to be just a little too good to be true.
Yeah.
And I had to sort of pull her back from that. She ends up being, you know, sort of a catalyst for a lot of stuff that happens. But as a character, I feel like if I wanted to, you know, if I had all the time in the world to make this, you know, the perfect, you know, platonic ideal of the book in my head, I would have given her just maybe a couple more facets. I definitely know people like her who just, you know, connect everyone they know in this weird, effortless way that you know, it would never occur to, you know, someone like me to do, because I'm a, you know, I tend to be like this introvert, at least around, you know, people I don't know. And I would never think of saying, oh, you need to talk to this other person here. Here's their email address. And, you know, you guys are going to be best friends. Like, and have it actually happen. And
yeah, she's like a networker a century ago. And I'm like the worst networker in the world.
Me too.
And even if I get someone's email address, then I lose it. And then I forget who they were anyway. And I put in my notes their name, but all I put is their name. And then when I look at it, I go, well, who's this?
Exactly.
But, it's almost like you can almost get irritated at her because she's so nice, you know. Give me a break.
Yep.
Except she doesn't like the genie, that's for sure.
Yeah, and that was sort of like, I don't know, her one interesting sort of saving grace, as far as I was concerned, was that she had this sort of sense about him that he just wasn't what he seemed.
That's the thing about both of them, the genie and the golem. You talked about a tightrope, and I think in one of your interviews. No, yeah, you talked about the tightrope when Harper Collins finally said, okay, you were kind of like, you know. But both of those creatures, they walk a tightrope.
Yeah.
They're between two worlds. And the genie eventually recognizes, you know, like when he's looking at the arch and talking about God and humanity's mistaken belief that there is a God. And he's saying, look at the arch. Yeah, it's beautiful, but it doesn't do anything. It doesn't grant any wishes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's so sure that everything human beings believe in is just, you know, a bunch of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And the Golem is so empathetic, she can't help it.
Yeah.
And it's the clash between the two of them that way. And also the fact that, I don't want to give anything away. Also the fact that their relationship is one that's can never be kind of perfect, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's really hard to convey. And you do it so well.
Well, thank you. It took a long time.
Tell us about that research process, because it is fascinating.
Well, so when it became clear, you know, when I started, you know, when my friend gave me that idea, I was like, oh, this is a neat little short story. I'm going to work on this for, you know, a month or two. And, you know, everyone in my workshop told me, no, this is not a short story. This is a novel. And I didn't believe them until, you know, what happened was the ending that I was writing towards kept pushing out, was like chasing the horizon. And I realized, no, this is a longer, they were right, this is a book. It might be actually sort of a big book. And so at that point, I was like, oh, I need to know everything. So I went, you know, I was lucky enough to be at Columbia, and I had the Columbia Library right there, and I just started researching from square one, you know, what was life like in 1899 in Manhattan, and what was, you know, the Lower East Side like, and Little Syria, which, you know, I think if I'd started the book now, there might be a few more resources. There have been a few more sort of a little more spreading of knowledge about that, you know, Little Syria actually existed where it was, and you know, scholarly studies and so on. But I had to sort of hunt, most of the Jewish people in the book are Orthodox, and I grew up Reform, and Orthodox, you know, sometimes feels like a different religion entirely. So I had to, you know, do a lot of research there. And the first 2 years were almost 50-50 research and writing. And it was just me in, like, the Columbia Library basement with my stacks of photocopies and you know, checking out as many books as I could get. And then, you know, like a year into that process, my classes ended, and my husband got a job out here in California near San Francisco. So, you know, we moved out here, and then it was me writing when I could, you know, when I wasn't, you know, working part-time jobs and doing, you know, these, either being an executive assistant or tutoring or, you know, all these weird, bizarre little internet article writing jobs that were just terrible. But to pay the bills, and then, you know, I spent the rest of my spare time writing and Googling, you know, basically everything. It turned out the New York Public Library, their online digital archive, was just instrumental. That, you know, any year, any street corner in New York, you can find a photo. And that was, you know, like you mentioned, the scene that takes place in Washington Square Park. And there's a part of that scene where there's a couple that rides through in a sleigh, in a horse-drawn carriage, in the snow. And that I got because, you know, I saw a photo in the archive. It was an aerial photo. I think it might have even been an old postcard of Washington Square Park in winter. And you can see these sleigh tracks running through the snow around the fountain and around the arch. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. People, you know, had sleighs that they would, you know, go joyriding in. And so that's, you know, how that detail got in. And the research ended up really creating so many ideas as much as just sort of giving me the basic information that I needed to work with. It also killed quite a few ideas. You know, I'd sort of come up with some, you know, oh, what if, you know, this happened? And then I would, you know, some bit of my research would tell me, no, never in a million years would that happen in 1899 New York. It just, you know, either wouldn't fit the culture or the technology wasn't there or whatever it was that I had, you know, sort of come up with in my brain. But as usually, more often than not, as part of, you know, that process of killing the idea, which, you know, I was never happy about, some other detail would come up and I'd be like, oh, well, this could happen instead. So, you know, I've had a lot of people tell me that, you know, oh, you must know so much. And it's like, well, I knew, you know, I always knew just enough, you know. I always knew just enough from the research. It was like sort of mountain climbing, and I would, you know, reach the end of my rope and I'd have to go research and tack another rope on, and then I'd reach the end of that rope, and then I'd go, you know, research, and it's, there were times when it felt sort of seat of my pants, but it sort of, you know, I haven't had too many people email me and tell me all the things I've gotten wrong, so I figure I did an okay job.
That's pretty funny, because I had, when after I read your book, I had a dream about it.
Oh.
And in the dream, I was writing the book, and in one paragraph, I was talking about Little Siri and Summer. And then I made this mistake, and in the next paragraph it was winter. And then someone on Amazon reviewed it, and they go, "Please explain how in one."
Oh, I got things wrong. The one line of Hebrew I have in there, it's not even line, it's like a phrase. Yeah. I got completely wrong in the hardcover. I said bar mitzvot instead of b'nai mitzvah. If you want to talk about kids, you know, becoming bar mitzvah, if there's more than one, it's b'nai mitzvah, it's not bar mitzvot. It's like saying attorney generals instead of attorneys general. And I got maybe a dozen emails correcting me on my Hebrew. And it's like, oh, my Hebrew school teachers are just shaking their heads at me right now.
My Hebrew school teacher, when I would do something like that, would just throw the eraser at my head. And he could hit my head from like 20 feet.
Oh, my God. Old school.
Oh, yeah. It was all really old school. But I was Reform. And, it was Reform is a piece of cake. You know, your Torah portion, your half Torah portion, you're done.
Yeah.
But, you know, Orthodox is kind of mean. And you have to do the whole service, and
oh, yeah.
It's horrible for women, and, you know.
Yeah, my dad talks about his, the shul that he went to. He had to go for like 3 hours every day after school, and he said it was like they'd imported them straight from the shtetl. It was just this very, you know, old Europe sort of the guy who yelled at you, and like you said, like your eraser thrower would have fit in perfectly at my dad's old shul. And
I didn't mind it because I was so fascinated by the skill he had.
You're giving him points like the Olympics.
Yeah, I didn't mind getting hit. It was just like I watched the arc, and, you know, he threw it. He had this really interesting way of holding it, almost like spiraling a football.
Huh.
And it was really nice till it actually made contact. Hey, well, so was Michael in the book kind of like what happened to you with regard to religion and Judaism?
Oh, good question. I don't think so. I'm not nearly so decisive in my opinion on religion as Michael is. Michael, you know, sort of grew up Orthodox and then just sort of chucked it all and decided that he was that atheism just made much more sense. And I'm much more on the wishy-washy agnostic sort of, you know, everyone rolls their eyes when you say you're agnostic. It's like, oh, come on, get off the fence. But I feel like I can't know. I don't know. You know, I am sort of in awe of people on both sides of the belief scale, on the, you know, absolute belief and absolute disbelief. I sort of feel like it's like that's the pull for me is not, theism, atheism. It's absolute belief and absolute disbelief. That to me sort of feels more like the poles than any, you know, than the object of what it is that they're believing.
It's like go ahead.
Mm-hmm?
I was going to say it's like Pascal's wager. You know, you might as well believe in God. Because if he doesn't exist, nothing happens. If he does, you're going straight to hell.
Well, and the whole hell thing and whatever. It's like, yeah, I don't feel like I can quite believe in that. Like the very detailed sort of, you know, and the whole Dante mapping it out. And it's like, wow, that's really detailed, and I'm not sure about that. But the... I don't know, just about the mind state.
I know what you believe right now, I can tell you. Here's what you believe. You believe that when you die, your consciousness goes and joins this greater consciousness, this universal consciousness that doesn't really care about what happened on Earth or who your mother and father were, but you join this greater consciousness, right? That's what you think.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
I sort of, in my good moments, I feel like when we die, we all go to the giant, awesome library in the sky. And there's, like, it's all your friends are there, and you have all these great conversations, and it's always sort of like that glowy 1:30 in the morning feeling in college, like, we are solving all the world's problems right now, and no one has ever had these conversations that are as deep as ours, and, you know, I'm going to have another glass of wine, and we're going to talk about these awesome books, and it's just...
Yeah, when you're
it's
in
like a giant dinner party.
When you're in an altered state of, you know, it's like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, actually. yeah, but when you're in an altered state of consciousness and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you don't solve the world's problems; you solve the cosmos's problems.
No, exactly.
But yeah, I think, you know, I can see you researching and just researching and writing things and Xeroxing. And there must have been moments where you got so excited because you found things and you wanted to go tell somebody. Uh-huh. No one would understand what the heck you were talking about.
That was usually when my husband got an earful.
Oh, I was just thinking exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
But there must have been like little Christmas mornings for you.
It was. It was, you know, there were usually like if I'd been thinking about some dilemma for 3 days. And, you know, because there were multiple times when it was like, either I'd written myself into a corner or some piece of research had just completely scuttled whatever idea that I'd had. And it was like the opposite of that. It was the nadir. It was the, this is never going to work. And I might as well just go back to marketing and PR and, you know, what was I thinking? And then it would, you know, somehow either through research or just because I thought about it long enough and got out of my funk and started, you know, thinking, you know, creatively about it, it would just completely turn itself around, and whatever it was that I'd sort of decided was going to be the thing that killed the book ended up being like the kernel of the idea that was going to make it just that much more interesting to me.
And for a first novel, if you think about it, you know, novels deal in weeks or months or years. Your novel's dealing with eons, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
yeah.
It's yeah. Tons of characters and tons of time. The only thing that's delimited is kind of spatially. But but actually, that's not delimited either. Because, like, the last journey that the genie makes, you know, when he goes to do what he does, and he's kind of judged, you know, and it's like on the... And I wasn't sure, you know, okay, what are they going to do with him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was fascinating. That was a really well-done part, too.
Oh, thank you.
And also, when you were talking about the carriage, that passage, when they kind of glance, you know, there's these glances back and forth...
Uh-huh.
That was fascinating, too. It was kind of left, you kind of left that kind of like, I wasn't quite sure what the couple in the sleigh were seeing.
Well, and that was, you know, sort of relating back to how I envisioned the golem as sort of being, there's something just a little off kilter about her, that when you look at her, you know, if you give her more than, you know, just a little glance, like you can't quite figure it out. And I figure with her and the genie standing there together, they're quite a striking couple in a way that, you know, they look like they just don't quite belong on Earth. And so if you, like, the two of them together, probably get a few stares, you know. Maybe it's good for them that they're only out walking at night.
What about when they're dancing in the dance hall? Holy mackerel.
Yeah.
I mean, and first of all, when the genie walks in, the women should just be swooning. Well, they kind of are. But yeah, the dancing, it's going to make a great movie.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, no, it's definitely going to be picked up if it hasn't been already. I don't know, but...
It has not been picked up. So if anyone out there is listening and has, you know...
Oh, it will be, definitely. And the thing about it is I've already cast it in my mind, kind of, but, you know...
Oh, gosh. People ask me, who are you envisioning? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know who anyone on the magazines are anymore. I'm still stuck in, you know, in the mid-90s.
Me too.
Sort of...
I went to the dentist yesterday and opened People magazine, and they didn't know anybody who was in it.
Yep.
But, you know, if it was like in the 50s or something, I think Yul Brynner would have made a great genie.
Oh, that's interesting. That would be interesting.
And the golem, if you did her right, could be a great Uma Thurman, I think.
I've heard Uma Thurman. I've always sort of pictured like a slightly less pretty Rachel Weisz.
Okay.
But
yeah.
Yeah.
But Uma Thurman has that aura and the height.
Yeah, she just looks like you're like, she's just not quite human.
Right, and she's not quite beautiful, but
yeah.
The aura is
striking.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
She'd be a good one. I mean, for a first novel, this is like a complete tour de force. So how are you going to follow it up? Or have you even thought about it? Or do you want to? Or now you're in the middle of everything. You're stuck in it now.
It's a little daunting to sort of have the bar set and know that people are waiting for the next one. It's, you know, it puts a little ice in my stomach. I'm just now starting to have, you know, after sort of the whirlwind of publication and, you know, sort of interviews and I was lucky enough to do some touring and that sort of thing. I'm looking ahead to that sort of calming down a bit. And in my, you know, spare hours, I've been carving out an outline, for the next book, which might very well be a sequel. We'll have to see.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. Well, you know what? The thing about it is that no one's going to wait 7 years, that's for sure. So you better get off your butt.
Hopefully less than seven, but probably more than one.
It's going to be two is going to be your max if you want to do a trilogy. You can end up being a trilogy, then there's going to be a box set, then there'll be the graphic one, then the movie comes out. It'll be like the Hunger Games.
My husband keeps saying, you know, we're waiting for the Happy Meals, when you can get your little Golem and Genie in the Happy Meal. Although, I don't know if they do toys in Happy Meals anymore.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't think so. Kids all swallow them and die.
Yep.
No, they'll be action figures, just like in the Hunger Games.
I am, for your listeners, I am completely joking about this. I am certainly not expecting any of that to happen.
Well, the funny thing is that I said this before, and my brother always listens to these, and he gets mad. But my brother likes books that have these endings where they're put into like a little box, and they're wrapped up, and then there's a little ribbon tying them together, and someone hands them to him. And I like books where the reader has to do all the work at the end.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what the hell just happened? And you want to, you turn the page, and you expect there to be another page, and there's not. Mm-hmm. But you kind of cut the baby in half in your ending, don't you?
Yeah, I really did sort of try to give it enough of an ending that there's going to be some note of satisfaction, but not so wrapped up with a bow that I feel like that closes off the book, and it takes some of the air out when that happens.
Me too, I think that.
Just out of the feeling that life doesn't do that.
No.
And you want some sort of feeling that these people are going to live on after the book has been closed. I tried to go for.
The interesting thing is that they both feel the way they feel for each other, if they really have real feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that they're willing to settle, but they know that it can't be like it is in other books, right?
Yeah.
It can't be that way.
That anything that they would have between them would have to be so hard to get and to deal with that maybe would it even, you know, in the end, would any sort of relationship, I feel like any relationship, any lasting relationship on them would exist on this balance of, is what we have to do in order to have this relationship worth the actual relationship?
Plus, on top of everything, which I thought was an incredible way of tying it up, actually, was the fact that their lives are inextricably tied up by the same binding, you know?
The same sort of machinery.
Yeah. I never really expected it to end in such a fashion that by fate they might be able to hang on for whatever, or it might be torn asunder at the same time.
Yeah.
You know? That was what's so cool about it. And I think this part of our conversation, I think, is not like a spoiler. I think people will be intrigued and go out and buy your book.
hope so.
Well, so, like, you know, I could go on talking forever. You have stuff to do, right? Are you done?
Well, you know, there's stuff I could do, but, you know, whatever.
Well, okay, so I was just going to say, like, Sophia, I feel bad for, and I worry about her, and, you know, I love her, kind of.
Oh.
Well, who wouldn't? What guy wouldn't love Sophia, seriously?
I get a lot of questions about, what is she doing in this book? Like, she's the only person, the only main character who isn't, sort of doesn't fall in one neighborhood or the other. And the answer really is, you know, she sort of started as this almost like sort of expedient character that, you know, I figured the genie needs a girlfriend and he's going to shoot for the top. And maybe I've been reading some Edith Wharton, so that's going to get worked in there too.
Ethan Frome.
And that, and she sort of went from being this, you know, sort of fancy plot point in a pretty dress to, you know, I got interested in her and I was like, okay, wait, no, who is she really? And then she sort of, you know, developed her own backstory and became a bigger player, certainly than I, you know, originally envisioned. And she developed her own sort of tragedy. And I don't know, I've got high hopes for Sophia. I figure whatever comes after for her, she really is going to be a life of her own making.
Yeah, but she still needs to be whatever, you know? I mean, mm-hmm. She's still not whole.
Yeah.
And not to be go on ad nauseum, but you got to read Winter's Tale.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating. Not the parallels. And I know it has nothing to do with you because you didn't read it before, so I know it hasn't. But you will,
to my shame.
Yeah, but you'll be amazed. And you both treat it differently.
Huh.
And there's and his is definitely magical realism. His is like, And the movie has to tread lightly on it too, which it won't. But it's definitely in two worlds. Yours is kind of in one world. His is kind of like Ben Marcus kind of thing.
It's right. Like, and that was what I'd heard about it. And that, you know, would have been a very different way to go with this book.
Yeah. Yeah, and you could have.
Yeah. But, you know, a world where basically all of this is accepted. But what I really wanted was this feeling that this is our world, but that this really could have happened. It's just that no one knew.
Right. No one knew. That's exactly right.
Like, it's really, oh my God, the geekiest thing I could say, but there was this, you know, when the Lord of the Rings movies came out on DVD and there's those box sets that have, you know, 17 hours of commentary and interviews and stuff. And there was one, I think in Fellowship of the Ring, where Peter Jackson is talking about what was sort of like the driving idea for him in like the design and the direction of the movie, which was that he wanted to view it almost as a documentary, that it wasn't going to be, look at these wondrous things. It was going to be, this is the world and we're doing basically, you know, like a war movie in, you know, it's like the equivalent of like a war movie in the real world. It's just that this happens to be the world that it's in. And it's, you know, that layer of, that level of realism applied to the fantastic, where it's not just the spectacles, but the mundane elements as well that get worked in. Really, to me, sometimes it makes it feel like a wholer world in that way, because you do have to deal with sort of the realities of, okay, how would a golem learn to live as a human in the real world? You can't just sort of change the real world to fit the circumstances. It's like writing almost the like writing a sonnet or something, where you've got this very rigid structure that you have to sort of push against and figure out how to, you know, work your way around it and with it, and that ends up resulting in some creative ideas that maybe you wouldn't have had otherwise.
That's an interesting way of putting it. Did you feel like you actually had those constraints and you had a stay?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
That was sort of that I, that was sort of a rule that I set out for myself early on, was that I would not change reality in order to fit the book, that I wanted to be as close to historical New York as I could be, with, you know, the history of, you know, what was going on at the time and, you know, the various neighborhoods and what were people really living like and what were the concerns and so on. And, you know, but things like, you know, like that I had just sort of assumed, you know, in my ignorance at the beginning of the writing process, that, you know, Syrian immigrants to the U.S. would have all, you know, would have been Muslim, and that was, you know, sort of the, That was certainly how the people at the time thought all the Syrians. Well, they thought they were Turks. They called them Turks because they were, you know, members, you know, they were subjects of the Ottoman Empire, but everyone assumed they're Muslim, and they were mostly, almost all of them were Christian. They were from what is, you know, now today Lebanon, and, you know, the Christian villages. And, you know, when I found that out, I was like, oh, well, now I have to change a lot because I want to stay true to that. I want to be true to the history of what actually happened. I can't just have all these people running around who are, you know, who are Muslim just because I want them to be. That's not what really was there. So I ended up having to research, you know, Maronite Catholicism and Orthodox Christianity, which I knew absolutely nothing about. All the Arab Americans I know are, you know, either Muslim or their families are Muslim, and that's where, you know, they come from. But that's, you know, that wasn't what the case was back then. So I had to deal with that.
Well, it must have been nice then to kind of like take a vacation and go with the genie to the desert and have his glass palace, because it, you know, then you had the luxury, you know, of having swarms of jinn, you know, being able to, you know, live in this ethereal world where they, you know, were like these will-o'-the-wisps kind of thing.
Yeah.
And
no, those were fun to sort of go back into the desert, and I think it's the 700s.
Yeah, 700s.
And just have, it was fun to play around with that and to sort of try to take some from, you know, the stories and legends that I researched, but also sort of put my own spin on some of it. That actually took a while that I had to sort of relax and allow myself to do. I had, at the very beginning, certainly, I was like, I have to write it. I have to, you know, out of this feeling of not just, you know, respect for another culture, but also just that I was so new at this. It was like, I have to write about jinn in the right way. I have to, you know, there's some, you know, sort of framework or ideal genie out there that I have to, you know, sort of follow the rules. And then I read enough stories that I realized that there were a million different versions, and really I could pick and choose. I would almost have to pick and choose in order to, you know, create something that wasn't this crazy, you know, sort of sew together amalgamation of different things. And that was, you know, when I sort of took ownership and decided, okay, this is my version and I'm allowed to do that because I'm a writer and that's what writers do.
Yes, you can lie.
yep.
Which always bothers me when I write, because I think it's like a stand-up comedian doing the same show every night. And it's like, can I do that? Well, yeah, of course you can do that.
Yeah.
But you just said reminded me of the other situation. I felt so sorry about Fadwad and Fatim. So it's so heartrending. And before the genie was bound, he still did that thing, which was not a good thing to do. And then he later feels like, oh, when I was bound, look at all the horrible things I did. But he does some horrible things before and he does some horrible things after.
Yeah.
Not because he's bad, but because he's different.
Yeah.
And curious person.
Yeah, he really is sort of a force of nature in that way, in the almost, you know, I don't want to say blameless because he is to blame, but there is that sense in which it is in his nature to not care and to just sort of be unthinkingly self-centered, not, you know, out of malice, certainly, but just out of a sort of built-in blindness to the effect that he has on the rest of the world.
Yeah, when you think about it, really, it's almost as if the genie is energy and the golem is the embodiment of matter, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And, okay, with that, we've talked for 53 minutes and 30 seconds. So I have thousands of other questions, but maybe we can talk again when you have your sequel written, and the movie rights. and then you have to decide whether you're going to write the screenplay or give it away. Oh, you got.
Oh God, I feel like that's someone else's job.
It
you
is.
Know?
It
yeah,
is.
I am far too close to it. I would be really interested to see what, you know, okay, take this, go play. You know, show me what you come up with. But
well,
that's sort of my feeling.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoy it. I mean, I really, really, really love this book. It's like my favorite book of the past, whatever. And
thank you.
And being a first novel, I just congratulate you so much. And you're such a nice person, too. So
thank you.
I really enjoy talking to you.
Wonderful time talking with you.
Okay. Well, so we'll talk again sometime soon, I hope. And thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was Helene Wecker talking about her book, The Golem and the Genie. It was released in hardback last year, and then actually December 31st of 2013, the paperback came out, and we have plenty of them at the Wellington Square Bookshop. She was a wonderful person to talk to. It's a great, great book. I highly recommend it. And it's her first novel, and she took 7 years to research and to write it. One of our best guests ever, I think. Next on The Avid Reader, we'll be talking to Laura Vaspinar, who wrote North of Boston, which is a thriller mystery that, and I don't usually read thriller mysteries, but this is really, really well written. It's a fantastic premise, and I won't give any more away about it till we talk to her next week. So, join us again on The Avid Reader. Again, I highly recommend The Golem and the Genie, and next week we'll be talking to Laura Vaspinar about North of Boston.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.